Chapter 26. The Case of Harry S. Music and Emotion. Perhaps one should not have favourite patients or patients who break one's heart, but I do, and among them was Harry S. He was the first patient I saw when I came to Beth Abraham Hospital in 1966, and I saw him frequently until his death 30 years later. When I met him, Harry was in his late 30s, a brilliant mechanical engineer. He had studied at MIT, who had had a sudden rupture of a brain aneurysm while cycling up a hill. He had bled extensively into both frontal lobes, and the right was severely damaged, the left less so. He was in a coma for several weeks, and remained irreparably damaged, so it seemed, for months afterwards, months in which his wife, despairing, divorced him. When he finally left the neurosurgical unit and came to Beth Abraham, a hospital for the chronically ill, he had lost his work, his wife, the use of his legs, and a large chunk of his mind and personality. And though he began slowly to regain most of his former intellectual powers, he remained severely impaired emotionally, inert, flat, and indifferent. He would do very little by himself or for himself, but depended on others for incentive and go. He still subscribed, out of habit, to Scientific American, and would read every issue from cover to cover, as he had before his accident. But while he understood everything he read, none of the articles, he admitted, excited his interest, his wonder, any more. And wonder, he said, had been at the core of his previous life. He would read the daily papers conscientiously, taking in everything, but with an uncaring, indifferent eye. Surrounded by all the emotions, the drama of others in the hospital, people agitated, distressed, in pain, or, more rarely, laughing and joyful, surrounded by their wishes, fears, hopes, aspirations, accidents, tragedies, and occasional jubilations, he himself remained entirely unmoved, seemingly incapable of feeling. He retained the forms of his previous civility, his courtesy, but we had the sense that these were no longer animated by any real feeling. But all this would change, suddenly, when Harry sang. He had a fine tenor voice and loved Irish songs. When he sang, he showed every emotion appropriate to the music, the jovial, the wistful, the tragic, the sublime. And this was astounding, because one saw no hint of this at any other time, and might have thought his emotional capacity was entirely destroyed. It was as if music, its intentionality and feeling, could unlock him or serve as a sort of substitute or prosthesis for his frontal lobes and provide the emotional mechanisms he seemingly lacked. He seemed to be transformed while he sang, but when the song was over, he would relapse within seconds, becoming vacant, indifferent, and inert once again. Or so it seemed to most of us at the hospital. Others had doubts. My colleague, Elchanan Goldberg, a neuropsychologist especially interested in frontal lobe syndromes, was not convinced. Goldberg stressed that such patients may involuntarily echo another's gestures or actions or speech and tend to a sort of involuntary simulation or mimicry. Was Harry's singing then nothing more than an elaborate, automatic sort of mimicry, or did the music somehow allow him to feel emotions to which he normally had no access? Goldberg was uncertain about this. For myself and many others at the hospital, it was hard to believe that these emotions we saw in Harry were simulated, but perhaps that speaks to the power of music for the listener. I had similar uncertainties when I saw Stephen Wiltshire, the autistic savant I have written about in An Anthropologist on Mars. Stephen barely spoke and normally showed very little emotion, even while he was producing his extraordinary drawings. But he could sometimes, so it seemed to me, be transformed by music. Once, when we were in Russia together, we listened to the choir in the Alexander Nevsky Monastery, and Stephen seemed profoundly moved, so I thought, though Margaret Hewson, who had known him well for many years, felt that at a deeper level he was indifferent to the singing. 3 years later, as a teenager, Stephen started singing himself, He sang the Tom Jones song, It's Not Unusual, with great enthusiasm, swinging his hips, dancing, gesticulating. He seemed possessed by the music, and there was none of the stiltedness, the ticking, the aversion of gaze that he normally evinced. I was very startled at this transformation and wrote, Autism disappears, in my notebook. But as soon as the music ended, Stephen looked autistic once again. I still wonder whether the music had given Stephen access to emotions that he normally could not express, or whether what we saw was a sort of impersonation, a brilliant, but in some sense superficial, performance. In 1996, the last time I saw Harry, 30 years after his accident, he had developed hydrocephalus and large cysts in his frontal lobes. He was too ill and fragile for any surgical intervention, but, though so weak, he gathered his last bit of animation and sang for me, Down in the Valley, and Good Night, Irene, with all the delicacy and tenderness of his earlier days. It was his swan song. A week later, he was dead.